From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park Podcast.
Welcome to the April 2022 episode of the Bletchley Park Podcast. Scaling up. Thursday, the 28th of April 2022, we'll see Bletchley Park unveiling its largest exhibition to date in the newly restored Block A. Its focus is the period from late 1942 to early 1945, when the demands of its crucial wartime work changed the Government Code and Cipher School from a cottage industry into an industrial-scale intelligence operation. The name of the exhibition, very aptly, is the Intelligence Factory. Block A was the first of the purpose-built block buildings that marked the scaling up of the code-breaking operation. Therefore, it's fitting that it houses this major new addition to Bletchley Park's visitor experience. Exhibitions manager and podcast host, Erica Munro, takes listeners through the same corridors that were at the very heart of the expanding top-secret site 80 years ago. Join us on an exclusive preview tour to uncover the stories, displays, and activities that visitors can explore as they walk in the footsteps of our veterans. It took a huge team of people to create the Intelligence Factory, and so for this special behind-the-scenes episode, research historian Dr. David Kenyon and research officer Dr. Thomas Cheatham will also be taking us through the rigorous historical research that underpins the entire exhibition. Tomatoes, ores, and coal-fired boilers don't normally spring to mind when you're thinking of World War II code-breaking. But in this episode, we'll find out what part they played in the story of the scaling up of Bletchley Park.
We're talking about a point in history where everything hung in the balance. When you're drowning in a sea of intercepted enemy communication, the question is, who is going to process all of the material? The only answer is rapid expansion of the workforce. But where are these people going to come from? And how do you train them in time?
We are working around the clock. They are going to need accommodation. They are going to need food.
I don't think it's possible to overstate the sheer volume of paperwork and information. This needed to happen on an industrial scale. And it needed to happen fast.
Up the Bletchley Park operation could change the whole course of the war.
I think scaling up is really the perfect explanation for the new exhibition that will be opening very shortly at Bletchley Park called The Intelligence Factory. And I'm stood outside it right now with exhibitions manager and podcast host, Erica Munro. I would say you look tired. But actually, you don't look that tired, actually. But I know how hard you and all the rest of the team have been working on this. How did this exhibition come about?
This exhibition has been years in the making. We were already well underway developing the exhibition before COVID, before lockdown.
Yes.
It's all part of Bletchley Park Trust's master plan and also fits in with our more specific exhibition objectives, which is to tell Bletchley Park's complete story, including its context, its impact, in the place that it happened. And with Block A being restored to heritage use, it had previously been office space, it gave us this perfect opportunity to tell the story in this building. We've got so many untold stories at Bletchley Park, and being able to pick ones which we can tell and having the chance to tell them is a real challenge. So the chance that we had here was to tell the story of Bletchley Park's latter wartime story, 1942 to 1945, covering the huge expansion of the site, the personnel, the work, the output, and also to make the point that we do elsewhere, but to reiterate that it wasn't just code breaking going on at Bletchley Park, it was intelligence analysis, production, and the opportunity then to disseminate it to commanders in the field and leaders to make real impact on the war.
Back in 2014, when we had the major restoration and we opened up Block C as the visitor centre, and then the rest of that was concentrating on the huts. Now, that, as you say, is the earlier part of the story. It's that first part of the war when it's kind of like a cottage industry. This is that second part of the war where Bletchley as the title says, becomes an intelligence factory, isn't it?
Definitely. And it's been, for the size of the story, underrepresented so far in the narrative that we've been able to tell. And the wonderful part of the fact that we have Block A here is Block A is the first building that heralds that new phase of development and expansion. It's brick built, it's two story. It shows that sort of temporary to permanent movement within the organization. And having that chance to tell that story in this space, and some of the stories we tell are very specific to the room that we're in as well,
yes,
has been an absolute joy. I should say it's been years in the making, but it's also been a massive team effort. There have been so many people involved in this. And I am one very, very small part of a lot of different cogs in a very large machine that has produced the intelligence.
You're
factory.
Just the one who pulled the short straw and has to get interviewed by me, aren't you?
I love being interviewed by you, Mark. So why would I not try and pull that short straw? I should say that we're focusing a lot in this episode on the stories that are being told in the exhibition and the background to those. And so in the content development team, I suppose, that was kind of really fundamental to that, I do want to mention Dr. Emily Scott-Deering, who is our interpretation lead. She's the sort of master storyteller that has come in and looked at this huge story and been able to bring together the threads that best help explain what we're trying to explore within this exhibition. And obviously that has been supplemented by all the really robust and thorough research work done by our research historian and our research officer, very familiar people to our podcast listeners, Dr. David Kenyon and Dr. Thomas Cheatham.
I want to go through a bit of background with both of you. Did you pick which bits you'd do?
No, he told me because he's in charge. He said, I'll do the plotting room and the fun stuff and you do everything else.
He admits so. He got the right choice. He loved it.
It turned out all right.
Well, it fell into two parts because there is the story of Naval Section that inhabited the building. And then there's the broader story of how the blocks came about and the other wider site stories. And it was obvious that we needed to divide it up. We've never done an exhibition quite this large before. And whereas previously with D-Day and the bombs, again, the research was me, but this time, because we had two of us, we had the opportunity to divide and conquer and to share out the workload. And it naturally fell into two parts, really. It wasn't a, how should we divide this up? Once we'd worked out the scope of the exhibition, it was fairly clear that there were two sides to the story.
Was it fairly clear, Tom, that he was going to do the big bang stuff and you were going to be digging through the archive for documents?
Well, we've both done a lot of archival digging. But the fact is, when you are looking at making a new exhibition, you're never quite sure where it's going to end up. It always develops and evolves. And so, you know, we're in the position where we can go away and say, here are what the interesting stories are, and we can mould the direction in which it goes.
I use the sort of classic inkblot analogy that when I first came here, the first couple of exhibitions I worked on taught me about a little sort of tiny part of the story. And then the next one I did filled in another patch, and those inkblots are now starting to overlap, to intersect. And so no research time is wasted from that point of view. The other point is, if you find a story that you think is suitably representative and is a really great story and will communicate to the visitor, that's not enough. This is an exhibition, it's not a book. So there need to be objects, images, audio, whatever it is. There need to be tangible things that we can use to tell that story. And so doing all the research is fine, but if you don't have the objects to illustrate the research, then you're a bit stuck. So the other thing that we did, or Tom did, was collections research.
Yes, obviously we hold a lot of different objects. And because our collections go back so much further than actually anyone who actually currently works here, part of this project was an opportunity for us to go in and discover things we didn't know about. And in some cases, we've made some really interesting discoveries. And in general, we got a much better idea about what our collection actually looks like in the round, which will all feed into, you know, our general museum's work going into the future.
One of the aspects of the story that we haven't really explored in other exhibitions, and I knew relatively little about before we kicked off this, was the Japanese story.
Yeah.
And the one thing that my ink blot has got a lot bigger on in this is the Japanese story, because I've not had reason to research it because we haven't really told it. And Block A is a really great opportunity to talk about the Japanese, because a huge section of Naval Section's work in Block A was on Japanese codebreaking. But we have materials in the collection that we know are something to do with the Japanese war, but a lot of it, we didn't know exactly what it was. And so it was a case of Dean, our archivist, fetching all that stuff out, and Tom and I getting to handle it and look at it and go, what actually is this? And fortunately, we have contact with Peter Konitsky, who's a retired professor of Japanese from University of London. He was really useful because we have books in the collection, for example, that the catalogue might say that they're this really interesting code book, but because the whole thing's in Japanese, we have no idea what it is.
No. Yeah.
So we'd send him a photograph of the cover and he'd write back and go, no, this is a high school dictionary from 1937 or something like that. You know? And sometimes these things were underwhelming in that sense.
But one thing Peter was able to do was give a translation of a Japanese message, which we're showing off in the exhibition, which we think is unique. Japanese messages, full stop, are very rare, and we don't have any other examples. And he was able to give a partial translation, but actually he said, because of the way the Japanese language works, you can't always give a full translation because it's full of homonyms.
Yeah.
So, you know, he ran into that same problem that the codebreakers ran into in the 40s, so that was really fascinating to see.
There were other equally exciting discoveries. I mean, there was a whole lot of material that I was able to identify is English translations of several Japanese code books that were physically captured. And there's these pieces of graph paper with these elaborate sort of charts of radio frequencies and call signs and other information on them. And we now know what those are. They're amazing things, but they didn't tell the particular story that we were telling in the exhibition. So it's really nice to now know what they are, and we will no doubt exploit them for something later on. They're something we can use in another exhibition.
Do you both seriously think that you have a better understanding of what we hold here now?
Yes.
Yes. We understand much better the broad scope of what the collection covers and what it doesn't. And in certain cases, we're also able to increase the detail of what we understand. And a good example is, as part of this exhibition, I was able to look at all of our indexes and work out what they all were. Because we have boxes of these card indexes, which mostly were given to us by GCHQ. They've been sitting in the GCHQ archives for 60, 70 years before they came to us. And they are very difficult to understand at first glance. They're quite cryptic. You need a detailed knowledge about what was going on here. And I was able to, in most cases, say, this is the section we think built up that index, and here's the purpose that they put it to. And there were some really interesting examples in there. For example, we have the discriminants index, which was used in Hut 6 to record the cipher keys used by the Germans and the spot repeats. They would sometimes use the same key again, and they'd spot it using this index. And having that knowledge turns these cards with three-letter character strings on them, which are very nondescript and not very interesting to look at. If you know what it is, it has a really important role in the story of Breaking Enigma. But you need that historical context to be added, and that's what I was able to do with all the indexes.
And it proves those indexes worked in the first place.
Yeah, they still work. You can still look them up. It still matches information we have. So the history of Hut 6 gives an example of one of the discriminants that was repeated, and I was able to look it up in the index and it all matches, and that's fantastic.
There's a glorious feeling when the research we're doing, which is kind of in your imagination, really.
It's born out in physical.
You find a physical form, object that brings it to life. That's why we turn up to work every day. Yeah.
To get that in your job, when those things happen, it must be amazing.
It is, yeah.
It's like the best jigsaw you've ever done, because when you're doing history right, everything fits together. You know, you're not just making it up. You're getting all the pieces and they all match. And so when you make those connections, it's incredibly satisfying.
Production space of the exhibition, it's a really impressive kind of lead in to what visitors are going to see. I'm going to be doing a bit of a walk around with you behind the scenes kind of journey, and we'll take the visitor route as we go. So we've just seen the main exhibition introduction with these two large screens, which really puts you into 1942, the moment where the war could have gone either way, and Bletchley Park begins this big expansion, this move towards this huge growth.
Because this is one of the things I think probably isn't stated enough. The point where this building opens in August 1942, the war isn't a done deal at all. So the powers that be here are putting a lot of faith into, I think we're going to win, or we need to do this to win, at least, don't they?
It really does feel in Block A like you're moving from office to office. There are long corridors. There's some quite dimly lit areas. They open out into some slightly larger spaces that we'll spend a bit of time in today. But also, we've put in a soundscape in various parts of the exhibition that sort of bring life to those spaces and make you feel like something's really happening in there and perhaps in the next room.
Lead the way.
I shall. Come with me. So after our first large introduction space, we begin in the first of the two spurs, as we're calling them, of the building. This is the first of these two long corridors. Now, we know that Naval Section was based downstairs in Block A when it first opened. And this gives us this great chance to talk about Naval Section, as I said earlier, in the place where the stories happened. Our first room actually shows a floor plan of Block A, Naval Section, where every room is identified and we can see which teams were in every single room. It's a copy of it. It's not the real object itself, but it means that actually we can show it larger and it's much clearer for our visitors to get this real sense of these very small offices, quite sort of silo working, independent spaces, but all working together for this one cause. And it's a real opportunity to show some of those very fragile, very rare objects or documents, or those that are based at the National Archives, where we can get copies and show them in a manner that visitors can get right up close to them, or in some cases, touch them. Well, as I mentioned, Naval Section was based in the ground floor of Block A when it first opened. But also, the way that the galleries are laid out means that we've got this opportunity to do almost a two-part story. And putting Naval Section in as our focus on the code-breaking effort, the intelligence analysis and intelligence production effort, is our way into that sort of the work story, which is then counterbalanced in the second half of the exhibition by the administrative and sort of everyday life story. So we are just entering a slightly larger room which focuses on objects associated with Naval Section's code-breaking efforts. On one wall, we also have a very large projected film, which is in three parts and is a really great example of the way we can use case studies of very specific times in history to then represent much larger stories about the impact of Naval Section's code-breaking work on the larger war. And this is all underpinned by David and Tom's research work. There were a lot of stories that were rejected, a lot of discussion that went on. And in their discussions with Emily about how best to show the really key, the really sort of overarching stories, they've happened on these three, which actually divide into German, Italian and Japanese stories. So it's a real joy in order to come to this room to sort of be immersed in the wartime story. And then that's supplemented by objects from Bletchley Park's collection, which also appear in the films and help bring the two together.
You can literally watch the film and turn around 180 degrees and there's the real items.
Yes, there are index cards in the film. There's a wonderful chart which shows the track of a convoy and the attack on it. There is a Hagelin machine that they can then see in front of them in the case itself in real life. And rather than focusing on those objects in the films, we've tried to show the wartime story and the impact in those films. But also, what is it without these amazing survivors, these objects that we couldn't not show? In fact, we obviously had to edit down which of those we could show as well. There are certain ones that maybe weren't as necessary to show or as relevant to show. And so we've had to make this final selection here of these very few but very, very key objects.
Yes, because the myth that every piece of paper was destroyed and burnt at the end of World War II, it's not true, is it?
No, it's not. But also, I should say that not everything in our collection is suitable for display. There are a lot of pieces of paper with gobbledygook on them. I'm not lying to you. And it requires a lot of this sort of back-end exploratory research in order to put that into a context that our visitors will be interested by, will help illustrate stories to them, and that also really supplement what they're finding out in the exhibition. We can't just, you know, paper the walls with completely random words and things that just don't make sense at all.
We've spoken about our archive here at Bletchley Park. Have you used any other sources to put this together?
Yes, we have. And regular listeners will be familiar with the fact that we used the National Archives in Kew in London a lot, because the majority of the material that was kept by GCHQ after the war has now been declassified and released to TNA, so the National Archives. So Tom and I spend a huge amount of our time down there. That's our first resource.
Yeah.
And a lot of material has come from there. But in addition, for this project, we were also able to go further afield to more specific locations. And the one that stands out for me was the UK Hydrographic Office.
Now, what's that and who are they?
They're an obscure branch of the civil service, and they're based in Taunton. And what they do is they draw and collect naval charts, maps of the sea. And what's rather fantastic is that they still do this, not only for the Navy, but for ships all around the world, use British charts, essentially. And so they've got all sorts of fancy computer systems nowadays, but they also have an archive of nautical charts going right back to the sort of medieval period, virtually. And part of that is their Second World War collection. And what's rather fabulous is they have a huge collection of the maps produced by the British government for the Royal Navy during the war. They also have a collection of all the captured maps, so German maps, Italian maps, Japanese maps. And I went down there for a day and just sort of had a rummage in their collection to see what they had. Where we use them specifically and where visitors will see the product is in the plotting room. You have to imagine a room where each wall has an ocean on a chart on the wall. And this map is 8 feet high and 10 feet wide. And then the Wrens would go in there and they'd plot the position of U-boats by pushing pins in and connecting them with string to show where they were going. As far as we can tell, the maps that were pasted to the wall, those maps still survive in the collection down in Taunton. The scary fact is you get one of these maps out, they're literally 4.5 metres long by 2.5 metres tall. And they come on sheets, each of which is the size of a poster, but there'll be 16 sheets in the map, you know, and they all fit together.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah.
Fortunately, the Hydrographic Office have a very large scanner, and they very kindly took all these maps and scanned them for us and tidied them up, and we got our design institution together. The maps you see on the wall in there are the authentic wartime plotting maps that would have been used at the time.
It's like another step closer to what the staff who were here during the war were working on.
Exactly. We haven't tried to recreate the room completely because we don't know exactly what it looked like. But there are certainly elements in there that would have been very familiar to the people who worked in there.
As well as spending myself a lot of time in TNA, I and a couple of other members of the team got to take a very fun trip down to Hursley near Winchester, which is the home of IBM. Because one thing we really wanted to include in this exhibition is a bit about the mechanisation of Bletchley Park. And we've talked about the bomb in Hut 11A, but another really good example of that is Hollerith, of course, my
favourite machine.
That fascinating bridge between mechanics and electronics and computers, these punch card machines that we used at Bletchley in vast numbers. It's about 2 million cards a week that are running through the Hollerith section. They used to solve this data management problem, which is what so much of the exhibition is about. How do you manage mountains of data and make something sensible out of it? So we really wanted to have one of those machines, and they're very difficult to come by, but thankfully our friends at IBM were able to lend us one of their Hollerith sorting machines. And so we got to go down there and see it in the flesh, so to speak. And it's an impressive machine. It's very, very heavy. Actually getting it up from Hursley here and then getting it inside the building has been a big logistical task on its own. It really has presence in the room, and I think visitors will be quite impressed to look at it and think about what it was used for. And as I say, it was a very fun day to go down to Hursley to have a look around their museum down there. They've got all sorts of weird and wonderful artifacts from the history of computing, and fantastic to secure that machine for our exhibition.
One of the highlights of this exhibition is the naval plotting room, which we are now standing in. We can see in front of us very large floor-to-ceiling maps.
It's impressive, I must say. I can say to the listeners, in all honesty, this is the first time I've been in the exhibition. I haven't been in here before. These maps are really impressive.
Exactly, and it's not, we've not just come up with this. Obviously, we've used sources in order to inform how this room looks. But as you can see, this does not look like the huts. It doesn't look like we have made a stage set in here. What we're doing is a representation of that World War II plotting room, because there are certain elements that we don't know about. There are no photos. And so we have created the sense of that plotting room with these large maps, with pins and string into some of these maps to tell particular stories. The pins and string that you can see, these are actually set out for particular events that took place during World War II.
So I'm looking now at a map of the North Atlantic Ocean, Strait of Gibraltar to Gulf of St. Lawrence, and it's more or less floor to ceiling. And it is exactly what you'd expect it to look like from any 50s wartime film, isn't it? There are pins in this map with pieces of string linking them to show the routes of the convoys, or is that the routes of the U-boats?
Convoy routes indicated here, and then U-boats represented by the symbols you can see here. And then in other charts, we've obviously got other types of vessels being shown, cruisers and tankers. So this is what we wanted our visitors to feel, is this... I mean, these maps are slightly overwhelming, aren't they? But all records that we have indicate that these maps were huge, and the ones that have survived are this size. And so this is certainly the feeling that we're aiming for, rather than, as I say, that perfect replicated 1942-43 plotting room.
And we know from our veterans that this is real. You know, this is as
this
close...
room is where it happened, definitely.
And also, it's as close as we can get to it, isn't it?
Yes. But what we've been able to do is not only show through these maps and pins and string, we've been able to then overlay interpretation so that our visitors can get more of a story, more of a sense of actually what took place and why, and what impact did that have in this space. So rather than just having maps and pins and string, we have some text labels with diagrams indicating some of the activities and explaining some of what went on here. But we also have audio points. We have one that has the voices of two of our veterans speaking about their memories of the plotting room. We have two very large interactive versions of this map, which I shall bring you across to just now.
I've got to say this. I think this is the closest we get to walking in the footsteps of those codebreakers during World War II, isn't it?
I really hope that...
These are so... This is so... I'm bound to say this, but I mean this. This is so impressive, the size of these. You get a feeling of what it must have been like for those 19-year-olds, those Wrens who came in here every day to do 8-hour shifts. They're literally watching the progress of a convoy across the ocean, but at the same time, they're plotting where those U-boats are. Well, it must have brought it home to them so much.
It must have done. And what I'd like to invite you to do, as our visitors will get the opportunity to do, is to not only understand how they must have felt, but also have a go at plotting. So we have these two large interactive surfaces in the plotting room.
These are interactive.
Where visitors can have a go at plotting some of these submarines and convoy routes.
Okay, I thought that was just a projection.
And now you're seeing the press here to start. So with a small amount of help to find where the coordinates are, our visitors can actually place pins and string onto the map.
Oh, Erica's smiling a lot because I'm literally dumbstruck because I didn't realise this enormous thing was an interactive.
Yeah, and it's touch surface. So you touch the wall as if you were holding that pin and putting that into that map. So this is hopefully going to really appeal to a lot of our visitors, perhaps the visitors that aren't interested necessarily in reading the words on the diagrams or looking at pins and string or listening to audio points. This is as close as we can get within a digital medium of that experience of plotting. You're getting the information from either from the Admiralty or from reports that come in or from intercepted messages. You're placing that pin in its place, being able to track both Allied and enemy vessels and aircraft and follow the course of the war. One thing I should say is, it's not every single one leads to a ship sinking, it's not attacks and daring do at sea. It is quite realistic in
that... It's what that daily drudge of the work at Bletchley Park for most of the people who worked here was.
Exactly, and that's the challenge for us, is to make a really interesting interactive experience, but that also shows what that slightly onerous task must have been like for Wrens every day of the war.
That is brilliant. Honestly, I didn't realise. I genuinely didn't realise. Now, would there be a personal reason, Erica, for the amount of work that you've put into this part of the naval section? Shall I answer that for you? Because our listeners probably won't know, but Erica's husband is a lieutenant commander in the Royal Navy. You have actually heard him because he was very kind in doing our French voiceovers for us, wasn't he?
He is also a star of the podcast, it's true. Yes, I've been a Navy wife now for, gosh, many years. So, yes, I have a personal interest in the Royal Navy. And, well, I love the plotting room anyway and what we've done in here. There's so many different aspects to it. But one of the elements that particularly interests me, I should say, is one of our contemporary elements. All throughout the exhibition, we've had these contemporary echoes of the stories that we tell in the spaces as well. And this particular one is about the Royal Navy and their modern version, I suppose, of plotting. So the software that underlies how the Royal Navy can track and monitor vessels worldwide is represented in this exhibition space as well, with a member of the Royal Navy, Lieutenant Commander Joe Black, interviewed. On screen, we can see the software in action where all of these ships are being tracked incrementally with huge amounts of detail and layering of detail as well. And it's just a really nice element of this exhibition that hopefully, again, will appeal to people who can see not only is this just history and very large and impressive maps, but this has modern day relevances and is still, I suppose, the techniques and the processes that underlie that plotting, mapping, tracking is still very much in use today.
What drew you to wanting to tell the naval story, David?
Well, I've always been into naval history.
Not just cavalry.
Not just cavalry. No, cavalry came later. I was interested in ships in the sea since I was a little kid. And in many ways, the gateway to the Bletchley Park story for me was through the Battle of the Atlantic and Naval Enigma and that whole story. The first book I read on Bletchley was David Kahn's Seizing the Enigma, which is all about the naval story. I actually read it a few months before my job came up. So I revisited it with a bit more vigour later. So the naval story has always interested me. And also, I think it lies at the heart of the Bletchley story in many ways. I mean, we're always telling people it's not all about Enigma. It's not all about the Battle of the Atlantic. There are other things. Let's talk about the Italians. Let's talk about the Japanese. But Enigma and the Battle of the Atlantic are nonetheless front and centre in there. They're a big part of
fundamental to the Allies' success in World War II, aren't they? Because without victory in the Battle of the Atlantic, you don't get D-Day.
Exactly. And it is a conflict that starts in September 1939 and carries on until May 1945. So the naval story is kind of all-encompassing in that way. But what was interesting for this project was to branch out a bit. I'm not unfamiliar with the Mediterranean and with the Italian naval story, but the contest between the Royal Navy and the Japanese Navy in the Indian Ocean in particular was something I knew virtually nothing about before I started on this project.
So I don't think many people do they?
Well, it's a bit of an untold story. And what's quite nice, we've put the Easter Sunday raid in the exhibition. We did the previous podcast about it, and it's a great story, but nobody's really heard of it. So all three sort of impact areas, Germany, Italy, and Japan, were stuff I would, you know, read in bed when I was on holiday anyway. It wasn't exactly work to kind of cover it. So that's been really good. This project has been talked about for a number of years. And from the outset, when we knew it was going to be Block A, I always said to myself and to anyone else who would listen that an exhibition in Block A has to include the naval section, because the naval section was what was in Block A. And if you choose to put an exhibition in there which talks about something else, and this talks about lots of other things, but you can't leave out naval section because it would be daft not to have it in there. And the plotting room in particular, the plotting room is one of those spaces where we know exactly where it was in the building, we know which room it was in, and we know roughly what it did, what it looked like. And so to not put that back, again, you'd be missing a trick.
It's a disservice, isn't it?
It is. And so my sort of mantra from the start was, no matter what else you do, you've got to do the plotting room, we've got to put that back. So I am very happy that the plotting room is back in. But the other major component of the naval story, because you work your way down the spur, and the first room you come into has the impact films in it, which are these three short films that talk about moments where Bletchley Park naval section's work impacted on those three theatres, on the Mediterranean, Atlantic, and the Indian Ocean. And that's really, really important, because part of the role of this whole exhibition is to move us away from cryptanalysis a little bit and say that the Bletchley story doesn't finish when you get the plain text of the message. It's not all about crypto. It's actually about intelligence analysis, about data management. Also, as Tom will talk about personnel management and information flow and all these kinds of things. So it was also really important for me that the naval section story stepped out of naval section and went out to sea, and that you had some sense that this had real world effect. The idea is that you watch the films and you feel yourself, you know, well, literally looking at Japanese bombers in the Indian Ocean, and then you come back to Bletchley Park and there are objects here that relate to the defeat of those bombers.
Because quite often in telling the story here, we can't point to tangible, actionable events, can we?
Well, we tend not to, because we try and emphasise this point that a lot of the success of the place is about aggregation of intelligence and the long-term picture and building things up. But it is also possible to tell individual success stories as well. And in some cases as well, I mean, the Italian convoy story, for example, we tell the story of one incident, but it's one incident among many. And it's what we were talking about earlier, this idea that you pick a real moment, which may only be a little moment, but it stands symbolic for a whole campaign. And that's what the Skirky Bank story does in there. The other thing that the Italian story does, which I think is really important, is it kind of turns the tale on its head, because in that case, decrypts of Italian naval traffic aren't being used to protect British convoys from attack. They're allowing the Royal Navy to attack Italian convoys. Mm. And we so often talk about the Battle of the Atlantic in terms of saving lives, you know, this sort of defensive function. But you have to remember that at least 50% of this work is offensive. It's giving our own armed forces an advantage to fight and to defeat the other side. And the story of the Italian convoys in the Mediterranean is a particularly tragic one, because their losses were way greater than the losses that Allied convoys suffered in the Atlantic. So that success was substantially owed to signals intelligence, because we knew when the convoys were sailing, we'd just sail up and attack them.
What work were you doing?
I was doing Italian Air Force, and we were doing these departure and the arrival in their various destinations, all these bombers and things from North Africa, intercepting them.
I mean, that was absolutely vital in 1941.
It was terribly exciting sometimes. I mean, the feeling in the office when you knew you were ahead of the timetable and they hadn't yet taken off, and you were able to get the message through to night fighters, and then they'd go up and shoot them down. And then, you know, there was a wonderful feeling of triumph. I never thought that the poor men were being killed.
One of the issues that came up right at the beginning of the discussion of the naval section content for the exhibition was Enigma. The designers were very keen to place an Enigma machine, a German naval Enigma machine, in the exhibition. And the idea was that you'd walk in and you'd be introduced to naval code breaking through, in this case, a four-rotor Enigma machine. And we have one in our collection, which we could have used. But my objection to this was that Enigma wasn't actually decrypted in naval section.
Was it not?
No, it was done in Hut 8, set up by Turing and then subsequently run by Hugh Alexander, which is a separate organisation. And in a similar way to the fact that Hut 6 produced Army Air Force Enigma and then it went to Hut 3 for analysis and distribution, the same thing happens on the naval side, that Hut 8 produces Naval Enigma and then passes it to Naval Section, who then do the analysis and the distribution.
Oh, so Naval Section are kind of the Hut 3 for...
for the Navy,
ah,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so I felt that to put an Enigma machine in there was putting it in the wrong building, if you like, because that wasn't actually what was going on in here. And also, if we're going to put that four-rotor machine on display somewhere, there are, you know, other things we could potentially do with it in the future. So there was a bit of a discussion about this, wasn't there, Tom? I can't remember. You were initially in favour of an Enigma, weren't you?
I think I'm still on the fence about it because it is such an iconic machine.
Mm.
And, you know, if you can grab your audience with something like that from the get-go, that can be very helpful. But I completely see David's point of view on it. It is the wrong building for Enigma. And the other thing, I might be pipping you to the post here, is that Naval Section, of course, does a lot of its own code-breaking, which has nothing to do with Enigma at all. And we wanted to tell those stories as well.
This is the thing, in terms of Block A and Block B, which Naval Section took over, a huge amount of the space in that building was occupied by people working on Japanese codes. And Italian codes were broken downstairs. The famous Nightingale machine, well, not that well-known Nightingale machine, which was a sort of mechanical analogue for Hagelin, was installed within the exhibition space. We don't interpret that room directly. So Italian code-breaking was going on there, Japanese code-breaking, German dockyard ciphers and non-Enigma code-breaking. But the one thing they're not doing is breaking Naval Enigma. So I kind of put my foot down a little bit on that one. And actually, the result is that you go into that space. And we have German material in there. We tell all three stories from the three countries. But we do it in, I hope, a slightly more innovative, slightly less familiar way. And we do have a cipher machine in there because we have a Hagelin C-38 in there, which is similar to the machine the Italians used. So it was interesting to sort of challenge what most people's perception of what this bit of the exhibition was going to be about a little bit. We were saying before, you do a lot of research, you have a lot of ideas, and not all of it makes it through. But, you know, I will smile afterwards because we've got a plotting room, which I wanted from the very beginning, which I think is going to be amazing. We've got the impact films, which takes the visitor out to sea and tells the impact story, which I'm very pleased about. And we've managed not to put an Enigma in.
Piece of metal in a new exhibition. Describe this to our listeners.
This big metal beast inside the showcase that we're stood next to is a Hollerith sorter machine, which is on loan to us from IBM, who have very kindly sent it up to Bletchley Park to be a real highlight of our exhibition. It kind of fills the space, doesn't it? But we've displayed it in quite an interesting way.
This is massive, isn't it?
Yes. As you'll see from the photo behind on the wall, it is one of a lot of machines that were lined up and constantly going in Block C in the Freebornery. This machine wasn't at Bletchley Park. This is illustrative of exactly the type that would have been here. But it really brings that black and white photo to life, doesn't it? And just, you can imagine the sound, the racket, what a pain that job must have been. It's a thrill to have it here as well, because even though it's a very small room that it's displayed in, it definitely is a huge feature.
Well, it does impress you with the size of it, it must be said.
It does. And collections display is, in this bit of the exhibition, is a really nice area that I'd like to highlight just now for you.
Come into another room and we're sort of faced with a reproduction of a filing system, would we say?
Yes, it sort of illustrates the idea of drawer after drawer after drawer of something. What could it be? Some of these drawers are propped open so that visitors can have a bit of an explore and see.
Oh, just have a look.
Yes.
Look inside, yeah.
So this is part of a really big area of collections discovery and research that Tom and David did, which has underpinned what actually is, I mean, it's a single room, but the amount of work that went behind it is incredible. So we are in what we're calling the cataloguing room, but on the wall is described as organising information about the enemy.
Because this is one of the big things about Bletchley Park moving into this more industrialised phase, isn't it? It's all about data management. It's about these 2 million punch cards that are printed a week. It's storing that information, isn't it? So it can be at hand immediately.
Well, when you say that huge number of cards, absolutely, those Hollerith punch cards, those machines were sorting, tabulating and so on. They're part of that massive administrative load.
And then another part is this, isn't it?
Yet the handwritten or typewritten cards that hold information that for us is probably a little bit more readable. I say that, but there are some cards we've got on display in here that are
very small handwriting.
Very neat handwriting as well. In this space, again, as I've said, we don't want to just throw cards at visitors which could say anything. So one of the real challenges for Emily, our interpretation lead, and the historians as well, has been how to select a story that illustrates the larger point.
Yeah.
And this has been really distilled in this space. And we've managed to do that by showing some real cards on display. So a couple of the cards that we've got on display here, real World War II Bletchley Park index cards that are particularly interesting, are these discriminant cards, which by themselves look a little bit confusing. One card says daffodil, mustard, leek, celery, garlic, beetle, cockroach. And then the other card is just three letters, almost,
yeah.
BHJ, GTV, BJO. So to your average visitor, viewer, listener even, those cards don't really say very much. But in the way that we've interpreted it as being able to keep track of enemies' codes and being able to log machine settings, suddenly it becomes a little bit clearer. Oh, I'm not supposed to understand what this means. But we've tried not only using original objects on display, which are sort of within their showcase, in their zoo, that we can sort of look through the glass and look at, but we've also produced facsimile versions of cards that visitors can get a little bit closer to.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm pulling out a couple of drawers here. But some of these other indexes that we don't so much speak about or haven't been able to, and these are just real bite-sized snippets, tiny views about what these cards looked like and the sorts of things that were being kept track of. So German secret weapons, Japanese words and phrases. Of course, we've asked our visitors to have a go as well. So we have some index cards. We've set them a challenge to find out some information from a selection of these index cards, which are, obviously, these cards have to last a long time, so you can hear me rattling them away there in their drawer.
But yeah, they're not on the original cardboard.
No, exactly. These aren't the authentic original objects, but they are very good representations of the actual cards. These are in Bletchley Park's collections, and the words on these cards are the ones on those cards. We're not
They're the original handwriting.
We're not dumbing it down for our visitors as well.
No.
So we wouldn't want to do that. But yeah, we have three opportunities to have different answers found within our card index. We've moved, you can possibly hear the sound has changed, we've moved into the corridor that divides the first spur of the exhibition from the second spur. And this gives me an opportunity to tell you about the very difficult architecture of the exhibition.
Yes, luckily with some arrows, are they going to be here?
They will be here, yeah. They're not just for our benefit. The layout of the space is, I mean, authentic to World War II. There are office after office after office, and we're not wanting to change that. But it does mean it's a little bit of a labyrinth sometimes, and has been one of the main challenges for the team who created the exhibition's content to tell what were quite big stories in very small spaces. We've done it through chapters, effectively, and had to...
Yeah, it kind of is, isn't it?
It is, exactly. So we've come to the sort of halfway through the book, or the halfway through the visitor experience of the Intelligence Factory. And we can see ahead of us the corridor. We can see the arrows pointing down to the second corridor. But within the space that we are right now, we've also put some quotes from veterans about their experiences here during phase of the war. Because a corridor is a transit route, we wanted to put in a quote from the wonderful Mimi Galilee, yes, who was a messenger here at a very young age. So we've been able to quote her saying, all the messengers there were girls and I was the youngest at the time and we had to deliver anything and everything. We've been able to make a little feature of the corridor as well by putting in the sort of representative lamps and pneumatic tubes where within them we're telling these little sort of, I suppose, lighter-hearted stories, such as the pneumatic tubes were occasionally used for sending frogs between departments. But if you look above your head, we've also installed here a Lamson tube within the corridor, which was very kindly donated to us and put in for this exhibition. So we've got the opportunity to at least connect the two spurs. We don't have any Lamson tubes still in situ that were here during Bletchley Park's wartime occupation of the building. The building's been in constant use since World War II, but we've been able to put one back in, and I hope that pneumatic tube fans particularly will appreciate that we have included the very striking curves of the pneumatic tube system. We know that they had these at Bletchley Park. We have photos as well within the sort of standard wartime photo set that we have available to us of the latter day Bletchley Park. In the blocks, there are lamps and tubes appearing in those photos. Heading into the second spur of the exhibition, we actually managed to put in the end. Oh gosh, my voice has echoed suddenly. There's a much smaller space. We put in the end of the Lamson system as well to show you what a sort of out point would have looked like with a canister in a basket dropped there for somebody to come and collect. So we move into the start of the second spur, which is our more administrative, organisational, broader story of the second half of the war and Bletchley Park story. And the marvellous face of Edward Travis greets us on the wall.
Jumbo.
Jumbo, indeed. Because this is where we explore how people were supported, recruited, trained, but also how it was all made possible. People needed feeding and housing, but we also find out about those in charge of it all.
Thomas David has explained to us that, you know, since a small boy, he's had this fascination with the sea. Not quite the same story for you, is it?
No, I can't say as a small boy I was, you know, putting myself in the shoes of the Bletchley administrators. I can't say that I came into this with a really solid idea of what we wanted to do. My role here was much more open-ended. And so really we were looking for where the opportunities were in the whole rest of the Bletchley Park story. And we had to include some things, you know, we had to talk about things like recruitment, housing, feeding the staff, and managing the site. And there were also some points of interest which we spotted pretty early on. We wanted to have Hollerith in there, and I've already mentioned that. We wanted to include the Morrison Wall because we think it's a fascinating sort of way of working that we thought we could really communicate to people and it would be really interesting. And has contemporary relevance as well. That's another thing which runs through this whole exhibition. We have points where we show a historical achievement or a historical process. Side by side with it is a modern day example of basically the same thing. And often the parallels are very similar because the process is basically the same. It's digital nowadays and, you know, the world is a very different place. But fundamentally, the way you organise information involves grappling with the same challenges and coming up with actually very similar solutions. So we think there's great contemporary relevance in what was happening at Bletchley Park, and we were able to pull that out at various points in the exhibition and show people that as well. So, for example, right next to the Morrison Wall, we have it's this network diagram. So right next to that, we look at modern day network analysis. You now do it using AI on a laptop, but the process of linking people together according to their communications and looking at that picture and saying, what does it tell us about what's going on, is fundamentally the same idea. Yeah. If you see somebody at the middle of your spider's web of communications, you know they're a big player and they're somebody to keep an eye on. The same idea completely applies today. There are also really good parallels in the way we organise information. You know, we talk about how information actually was organised using index cards. It looks so analogue and so alien to people nowadays. But at the bottom, the challenge is exactly the same. How do you get a mass of information and work out what's important and pick it out from this ocean of information? We still struggle with that today. So looking at how they did it in the 40s is really interesting. It's enormously big and complex. It gets to the point where you have to start looking at your terminology. We talk about Bletchley Park as a cohesive organisation, but a lot of the time it isn't. There are elements of the Government Code and Cipher School which are controlled from Bletchley Park but aren't at Bletchley Park. There are people working at Bletchley Park who aren't in the Government Code and Cipher School. Just looking at the lines of command and the lines of organisation can be very, very confusing, and it has been very, very confusing in many cases. And there are, you know, I can point you to umpteen books which get this stuff wrong just because it's very hard to get to grips with. You know, it doesn't matter what we want to do in the exhibition, we need to keep an eye on getting it right. That's our baseline. It needs to be factually accurate. Mm. So we need to do our due diligence. But when you look at the fact, you know, Block A is one block out of eight. They all have different teams in doing different jobs. They all fit into a greater whole. You know, aside from the intelligence and the cryptographic work, you have communications, you have all the administration that has to happen, those sort of ancillary functions, like running the transport, feeding the staff, all get bigger as well.
The listeners won't know, as we're recording this in Block A at the moment, because your offices are now above the new exhibition, aren't they? But this is the physical building where this growth begins, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the first block to open, just at the start of August 1942. But far from the last, and there are much bigger buildings that open the following year.
It's kind of the template for it, isn't it, in a way? Because the other buildings don't look the same, do they?
Well, it's the only block, along with Block B, it's the only block that's two-storey. You know, it harks back to quite early in the war when they've seen the site growing, the organisation growing. They've got an idea it's going to have to go on a permanent basis at some point, so they are making plans, and they start planning Block A a couple of years before it actually gets finished. And the idea is that your three main service sections will move into this building and it will be big enough for all of them. And by the time they're getting close to finishing the block, it's clear that the military section won't fit, so they leave that out. And then initially air section moves in on the first floor and naval section on the ground floor. But very quickly, naval section grows so much that air section gets pushed out and it goes over to Block F, and then naval section takes over the second floor as well as Block B next door and Hut 7, which is behind Block B.
Yep.
It just takes up more and more space. They realise actually after building Block A that this is quite complicated. It's more difficult to build a two-storey building, and they stick to a simpler design where they're all one storey and they just kind of sprawl out across the estate in these sort of spider block shapes. They're less worried about being spotted from the air, and they just keep things simple because at that point they just need to get buildings built as quickly as possible to accommodate all the staff.
Now, in previous podcasts, you've talked about the boring stuff and the sexy stuff, the code-breaking stuff and all of that. Why is the admin side of this story so important, Tom?
I think, well, I would argue that the most important factor in Bletchley Park's success as an intelligence agency in the second half of the war is not cryptanalytic genius. It's not very smart people in Tweed being very clever. It is good organisation and good administration. It's all, as we've already said, dependent on building up the big picture of what's going on. What I found out about, which was really fascinating, is how much of a people story and a drama there is in the administration as well. Because often they fix a problem, a new one arises, and actually by fixing some of their problems, they create more difficulties for themselves. They're always aiming for a moving target. And that's really interesting. For example, when they start building these military camps to house the service people who are working here, that's fantastic for the park authorities, because they don't have to worry about looking after their staff anymore. But then they have to spend so much time leaning on the military, on the army and the air force to get the camps built and then run them properly, that itself turns into a huge drain of time and effort for the managers. And it's about building up good personal connections with their opposite numbers, and about lots of kind of lobbying and being diplomatic and forceful at the same time. So again, you need the right people, you need skillful people who know how to do this organisational work. And they make as big a contribution to making Bletchley Park a success as the genius cryptanalysts do.
The other enormous asset we have, of course, is our oral history collection and our veterans. And through our colleague Jonathan, there's been the programme for a number of years now of recording all these veterans. And that, again, was a resource that Tom and I were able to dip into. And for any particular topic, we could search the oral history collection and find people who had actually done the tasks we were trying to find out about. I mean, this is your claim to fame in this exhibition, isn't it?
Well, it is, yes. I didn't want to say anything either.
You're allowed to pick up your part, Mark. Mark doesn't only edit Tom and I's ramblings.
I do have other clients, and I do the veterans listening posts in this exhibition, which is something I'm very proud of.
In the case of the plotting room, it's fantastic we've been able to use it as a real source of proper historical knowledge about what was happening. You know, these people, in some cases, they are the only people who can tell us how certain things worked. That knowledge only exists in their head. And that's a really good example of how important it is to be collecting that information and preserving it.
In my case, for the plotting room, we know that plotting room existed, but we know very little about what it was like inside. We've no photographs of it or anything like that. But we do have three veterans who we've recorded who worked in it. And I was able to go through their accounts and construct a pretty good idea of how the space worked and roughly what it looked like. But we were very fortunate that one of those veterans, Sheila Wilson, is still with us. And we were able, actually, through Jonathan, to go back to her and ask her more questions about it so that we could find out even more detail about what we were dealing with.
I have to get myself positioned to get the best.
Yeah.
I'll ask you to repeat things if I need.
That's of course, yeah.
What you're doing now.
Yep.
Is preparing a new book.
No, it's not a book. It's an exhibition at Bletchley Park about the naval section where you worked.
I see.
And particularly the plot that you worked on.
Right.
And you are one of the experts because that was your job at Bletchley Park.
Now, that sounded very august.
Good.
One of the ones left might know a bit.
Yes.
And I'll do my best. There's some memories which are quite vivid and some are not.
Of course.
But, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
But the whole memory of importance, I don't think any of us ever thought other than to look after this secret. That was definitely without exception. And we regarded it rather like a favourite dog. You know, you pat it, you look after it, you feed it. That was our secret. And we didn't have to invent it.
Yes.
And I think we thought we were jolly lucky to have landed in such a place. I think that was a general feeling. Anyway, that's not what you're asking about.
No, that's don't worry. It's the office you worked in I'm particularly interested in. When I saw you a few years ago, you told us about your office. So we're trying to get even more out of you now because we want to get it absolutely right.
I think we've just got to pick and choose what to use the most important. And I will try and be very careful not to make any errors, because I regard this as a kind of trust. I represent other people who are no longer here and who gave their lives or gave their comfortable background to preserve it. I regard that as a necessity to keep faith with them. I don't think I was in a position to know more than most people at that point. I was very young, about 19 or something, and most of what I did was quite routine. But I'm concerned that what does go should be as near truthful as possible.
Yes.
But what I do remember is often quite vivid and expressive of a unique time in history. So for that reason, one tries to keep it in good order, not add things or so. I'll leave it to you to ask.
Okay.
It's distinctly quieter in this room. Is there a reason for that? He says, lining up the question for you.
Yes, there is, because we have seized the opportunity to incorporate in quite a dense way here the voices of our veterans. We know how important it is to hear their words from themselves, their own stories. And in this room, where we are looking particularly at their experiences of being recruited and being trained at Bletchley Park, we thought it best to hand it over to our veterans and let them tell you what that really felt like. So we have a large bench down the centre of the room. Each seat on the bench, and there are four sort of seating areas, has an audio point next to it, and three of those contain a number of different tracks of veterans speaking about their memories of being recruited and trained here. So we have 12 different pieces of audio in here where, I mean, I could spend all day just sitting in here listening to the veterans speaking about what it was like, about their experiences joining the Wrens or having to go to a recruitment centre or being trained to speak Japanese. And another reason that we wanted to put seating in here as well, so people can spend time with these voices. One thing we've also tried to do where we can is to put photographs of those people who will come across as an older voice, but the photographs are them in the 40s. So that you can really sort of see and hear at the same time about these really different experiences. And that's another thing we aimed for, was a range of experiences.
So this allows our listeners to hear what it was like to be at Bletchley Park during the war. Now, if I turn around, is this dress up?
This is a selection of uniforms, civilian clothes that will help visitors imagine what it must have been like as well. Not just child size, I'm going to point out. We have adult sizes in here too, hats and jackets. So visitors can pretend to be in the WAF or in the army or a member of civilian staff joining, popping their uniform on or their clothing on and coming to Bletchley Park for their first day at work. How must they have felt? What must they have experienced? And above these hooks, we also have a big list of job titles that people at Bletchley Park would have done. Some very unusual ones, some very familiar ones. So linguist, dispatch rider, cryptanalyst. These are kind of very familiar, I think, to our listeners. But military advisor, meteorologist, librarian, photographer, stoker.
Hairdresser.
Telephonist. Book builder, which is a cryptologic job, not a publications job, but cleaner, head of section, real variety that we've gone for here.
One of the other really nice things about this exhibition is we always try and lead these projects with the key characters, with the sort of the major players. And I've already talked about how Enigma wasn't broken in naval section, it was broken in Hut 8.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, Alan Turing is in another building.
Yeah.
So we kind of don't need to talk about him. And we have these other people who don't necessarily get so much of a look in. I mean, on my naval side, you've got Frank Birch, who started out as head of German naval section with about three people that worked for him and went on to run an organization of 500 people and was head of naval section. Incredibly capable man and clearly delivered for Bletchley Park on the naval side. But at the same time, his new PA was appointed and she walked into his office and he was wearing a blue balaclava helmet and standing on his head. And she said to him, "I'm sorry, are you ready?" Because she was going to take a letter down. And he went, "I am if you are." And she's like, "Okay." So she sat down and took a letter with him standing on his head. He's an absolutely amazing character. He did code breaking in World War One, and then went back to Cambridge for a while and was a don at Cambridge, and then moved to the BBC and was producing radio programmes at the BBC. And then went on to act in stage and screen. He was in several comedy films before the Second World War. And actually, you can watch one of his films on YouTube. This extraordinary man then comes back to Bletchley.
He's famed for his Widow Twankey, isn't he?
Yes, he was referred to as Widow Twankey. Whether he actually played Widow Twankey at any point, or just the fact that he'd been on stage in pantomime, that was a suitable character to allocate to him, I don't know. And he lived in a pub in Little Brick Hill with a couple of the other senior figures from Bletchley. And they had quite a jovial time, from what we can tell. But again, his main role isn't to come up with methods of cryptanalysis. His main role is to manage an ever-growing organization of people and make sure that the genius cryptographers he has underneath him do their job and manage the relationship with the Admiralty as well. He's constantly in meetings with Admiral Godfrey, who's the head of naval intelligence, and all these other characters. And it's these people who don't do the direct cryptanalysis but do all the other vital stuff tend not to get mentioned so much. And his office is downstairs, and you can tell which one is his office because, and this crops up in Tom's memos again, he had it extended.
It's literally just below the window from your office, isn't it?
Yes, it's underneath us now. Because of the way the building's constructed with these sort of steel frame bays, every room is basically the same size, or it's multiples of the same box. But he decided the box wasn't big enough, so he had a sort of extension built out onto the grass outside. Actually, it was because he wanted to put a meeting table in his office so that people could come and have meetings with him and go egging. And he quite rightly made the point that having to traipse off to a separate meeting room and take all their secret documents with them and everything else would be a pain. But every time he includes this in the plan for Block A, an architect will come along and cross it out again. And there are a series of documents with him getting ever more irate about the fact that he keeps insisting on it. It clearly got built because it's down there. But the irony is by 1943, he'd moved upstairs up here and was in a different room. So it wasn't his office for very long. But he's one of these people. And I mean, Tom, you have the same characters on your side. I mean, Bradshaw's an amazing
character. Bradshaw is a fantastic character. He's described by Harry Hinsley, who we know how brilliant Harry Hinsley was. Bradshaw's described as one of the most capable men I have ever met. He's this dour Ulsterman who's also got Belgian ancestry, so he speaks French. Actually, he's in charge of the French naval section at the start of the war and a naval officer by trade. But he takes over the administration, and we talked about this in previous podcasts. From 1942, Bletchley Park is his to command, so to speak. And he takes on the role as a sort of what you would call a chief operating officer in a big company nowadays. He's not in touch with the work really at all, but he's in touch with everybody because it's his job to make sure everybody else can do their jobs. So he has to know everything. He has to know all that's going on. He has to, again, be very firm and quite harsh at times in allocating resources, about laying down the law, about making these quite difficult characters at times, you know, follow the rules. And he's got a particular dislike for people he regards as empire builders, people who try and amass power and responsibility for their own self-aggrandizement. He's completely against that sort of way of working. So he's a very rational, down-to-earth person. He's just the sort of person you want to keep a place like this running in a good way. You know, also, he's a nice man. He's got a sense of humour. There's a quite a funny episode where he's on a tour of the bomb hut along with Mr. Fletcher from Hut 6 and Vera Lawton Matthews, who is the head of the Wrens. And she rounds on Mr. Fletcher and says, "Why are my Wrens working alongside civilians?" And Bradshaw sort of starts to titter and has to stand behind a column to conceal this from Vera Lawton Matthews while Mr. Fletcher is standing there kind of weathering the storm.
Wasn't it that Vera Lawton Matthews said, "Why are my Wrens working alongside civilians?" And Fletcher's reply was, "Because we couldn't get enough civilians."
Yes, I think that's it. Actually, that's the other part of the story.
Vera Lawton Matthews was not expecting. So Bradshaw has to run off behind a column and chuckle to himself and then kind of come back out once he's got his breath back. There's one description of him that if you went into his office to ask him about something, he would bombard people with volleys of old-fashioned naval abuse. And the idea was that if what they came to talk to him about was quite trivial, they'd be defeated by the abuse and they'd leave. But if they actually stood their ground and kind of weathered the storm of swearing, he would then listen to them quite carefully and do what they wanted.
So we're in another quiet room, more oral history, I see. I'm glad to see more work's been used, as we said. But two different settings again.
Yes, we have feeding and housing. And the amazing resource of our oral history has been used in different ways across here. So we have the feeding area is sort of decked out like a 1940s kind of canteen.
Yeah.
We don't have photographs of the Bletchley Park canteen. It's really frustrating. Yeah. So this, with our illustrated urns on the wall there and some menus, gives you an idea about the sorts of food people were eating.
And we know those are real things from our oral history.
From our oral history, yes. So we've made these menus, corned beef with prunes and curried fish and jam tarts. They appear again and again in our veterans' interviews. And we also have oral history listening point in here as well. And then in our housing side, we've used some of those veterans' words in quotes on the wall and some of the photographs that they've donated at the time when they've done those interviews have also been incorporated in here, as well as yet another listening point.
I've never seen a picture inside Shenley Road Military Camp, and there's one of the famous stoves.
Yes.
That were in the middle of the room.
Absolutely.
See, this is what I mean. Every time I come to Bletchley, I learn something.
There are some absolutely wonderful personal photographs in our collection, as well as the sort of formal ones.
There's a lot of stuff here that I've never seen before.
So there are some wonderful objects on display in here as well, personal objects. So a scarf, a cardigan, a diary and a teddy bear.
Have those been given to us by veterans or loaned to us? Or
given to us and relate to their time at Bletchley Park.
Oh, that's amazing. That is so kind of them. Mm. We're now walking into what I guess is sort of the admin equivalent of the big wow factor of the plotting room.
Yes, this is the large room at the end of the second spur, where the plotting room is the large room at the end of the first.
Yeah.
And this is a sort of culmination of that administrative story in a room where we look at those in charge, the challenges they faced in keeping Bletchley Park's show on the road. And we let our visitors both have a go at those challenges, but we also let the facts speak for themselves in here.
that seems a quite difficult task to try and tell an interesting story about administration, Thomas.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in the archives going through these files, most of which are a bit like the Enigma messages, are mostly uninteresting, but occasionally you spot a piece of paper with something very interesting written on it that tells you a little story that evokes an idea of what Bletchley was like that you can see at a glance. And I realised if I were to pick out all of these examples, all these memos that say something interesting, there was potentially something there. And thankfully, our interpretation lead, Emily, was of a similar mind with me on that. So we've managed to come up with a couple of ways to use these little tidbits of information, these little vignettes, if you like. So what we've decided to do with many of these form what we call the memo wall, which is what it sounds like. We have a wall covered in memos, all administrative, real administrative documents from the archive. And the idea is you can just go up, read a few of them and go, oh, that's interesting. So let me tell you about my favourite. My favourite is about tomatoes.
Tomatoes?
Yeah. So there is a chap called Mr. Reed, and he works at the Bletchley Tomato Distribution Association.
The what?
The Bletchley Tomato Distribution Association, and his job is to make sure everyone has the right amount of tomatoes and that nobody's gaming the system, nobody's hoarding tomatoes, that everything's distributed fairly and evenly. Which is important, you know, in a country at war, when rationing is going on, you've got to make sure people are getting the right nutrition. And one day, Mr. Reed receives a letter from the Foreign Office, and the letter says, "Dear Mr. Reed, you're going to get a letter from an organisation at Bletchley Park, and they're going to ask you for some tomatoes. Please just give them the tomatoes. Don't ask any questions. Don't ask them what they need the tomatoes for. Don't run any of your algorithms for working out how many tomatoes they deserve. Please just give them the tomatoes. Trust us, they need the tomatoes." So who would have thought, like, to make Bletchley Park work, they need to contact Mr. Reed in Bletchley and just tell him to give Bletchley as many tomatoes as they want.
You're right, Mark.
This is genuinely the first time I've heard this.
It's the other one that I like is where, I think it's Travis, gets a letter from the vicar to complain that his churchyard has been overrun by pigs and that this is Bletchley Park's fault. Because Bletchley Park did have pigs that ate the swill from the canteen and would ultimately turn into bacon. But he explores the matter and is able to write back quite happily to the vicar and say, "Ah, these are not our pigs." They were actually belonged to the farmer up the road whose land had joined.
Captain Ingram.
Captain Ingram. They were Captain Ingram's pigs.
Nothing to do with us.
But once you get into the administrative archives, it's full of this kind of gold. And I mean, my other favourite is the minute from one of the organisational meetings where they say new oars have been acquired for the rowing boat on the lake.
Right.
You know, the small lake in the middle of Bletchley Park. But these will no doubt be destroyed in the usual short order. Because you can hear the venom expressed in it that apparently the wrens used to like to go out on night shift and row around the lake in the dark and sort of get up to hijinks. And the equipment of the rowing boat was destroyed on a regular basis.
And they do add a disclaimer that the use of the boat is at your own risk.
So if you fall in the lake and drown, don't blame us.
I wish the listeners could see that Tom's got a sheath. They must be like an inch thick of these memos in his hands at the minute. And a very broad smile on his face, so I imagine there's quite a few funny ones in there.
When they build Block B, it has a coal bunker, because they run all the boilers off coal, and they have a team of stokers. The first problem is that at one point they decide to reduce the pay of the stokers and they all quit. And so they have to reverse the government decision and agree to pay them extra, presumably out of SIS funds. The other problem is their bunker is right next to the road, and when the Ministry of Works turn up with the coal, they're not allowed to put it in the bunker, they just have to dump it, so they dump it in the middle of the road. Which means all of a sudden the park is cut in two and vehicles have to drive up on the verge to get around the big pile of coal. Meanwhile, there's a couple of stokers who are very much overworked, furiously shoveling all this coal into the bunker to try and get off the road as quickly as possible. But they have to do that every day.
What?
Because they have to run the boilers. So that's this big organisation to keep everyone warm in the winter.
It does tickle me slightly that Block B, of course, upstairs is full of naval officers doing Japanese translation. So the idea that there was a boiler manned by stokers beneath their feet probably made all these naval officers feel quite comfortable. It must have been like being on a ship. You got the rumble of the boilers from below.
The other way we were able to use some of these fascinating vignettes is to not just show people what happened, but actually let them make the decision for themselves. So at the end of the second spur, the sort of administrative complement to the plotting room in the first spur is an interactive where you will be given a decision and you have one of two choices as to how to resolve it. And you can see for yourself some of the dilemmas which the management here faced and the sort of decisions that were passing across their desk every day. And again, the sort of bizarre scenarios you wouldn't expect to come up that they have to deal with.
There's a series of these questions, isn't there? Are they all from real documents and real questions that were asked?
A minority are based on stuff we know happened, but we don't have the precise details. But the vast majority are directly from the archives.
Memos about tomatoes.
Yeah. So we have direct evidence that that scenario occurred. That was a decision that was made. And we have a good idea of, you know, what the rationale was and what the consequences were. So it's all based pretty directly on the primary source material. And so as a way to show some of this stuff to the public, it's, well, I'm very, very happy with how it's turned out. One of the decisions in the You're in Charge interactive is about dust, because there's a terrible problem with dust at Bletchley, because the roads are so bad and there's so much traffic.
Right.
And the roads aren't properly finished. People bring the mud into the buildings on their feet, and then it gets in the machines, it gets in all the teleprinters,
all the
machines and things, and starts to cause real problems. So we asked visitors to make a decision about this, whether you literally repave all the roads on the site or you hire new cleaners. And I'll give away the solution here because it's fascinating. Because early in 1944, at the point where really they're gearing up for D-Day, where the war is absolutely at its peak and Bletchley Park is working full pelt, The issue the administrators are dealing with is repaving all the roads and getting curbs put in to stop this dust problem. That is what's distracting them from dealing with D-Day. That is the sort of nonsense that they have to grapple
with. So one
with.
Side of the story is always Colossus is in place for the start of D-Day, but the reality of it is...
Alan Bradshaw is talking to the Ministry of Works about getting tarmac laid. It's just sort of, it's incongruous and feels really daft, but that is the fact of how this place was run.
And finally, after we've gone through about another half dozen rooms, here we are at the end of the exhibition.
Yes, we have a large space at the end where we very briefly focus on the sort of 1945 story, Bletchley Park at its peak, January 1945, and also the impact and the legacy of that work. There's a very large scale film as well that represents that busiest period of Bletchley Park's work.
So we've come outside now to where we started. It is enormous, isn't it, that space?
I suppose it's the division into those small stories feels that it is chapter after chapter after chapter after chapter, as if you're reading a book. So when you come to the end of it, in that 1945 conclusion almost, or not so much the end of the war, but the peak of the war, you sort of feel like you've experienced a lot. And we're hoping that visitors will feel they've learned a lot, that they've had a go at a lot of things, that they've been able to put themselves in the shoes of a lot of different people doing a lot of different jobs, that they've experienced the war story as much as the Buckinghamshire Bletchley Park story.
I think really it's kind of the perfect bookend. The huts, which are quite dark and the rooms are tiny and you feel like you're in a kind of shed as you're walking around. And you come in here and this is so different. It's like you know that they took this leap and changed this place completely.
The huts are quite an intense experience as well when you go in because they're so dark. You know the wooden floorboards as well and that makeshift feel. Whereas here, we haven't really gone for that set dressing approach, but you do still feel the life within the walls of this building as you move from room to room.
Definitely. I think from a personal point of view, I do this for a living. The soundscapes all the way through this exhibition, I have to say, are remarkable. They're so good.
And they bring the noises not just of sort of typewriters and telephones, but machines and loads of people walking down corridors, messenger trolleys delivering voices in adjoining rooms or outside in the corridor.
There's really ethereal things happening, isn't there? I'm really impressed. It takes a lot to impress me with all
that. I'm very pleased to hear it because it has been such a long journey to get here and such a huge amount of work to get to this point where we can then bring visitors in and share it.
And there's a lot of people who've done this. You know, we've heard from you and David and Tom, but, you know, that's just three people of dozens and dozens.
Absolutely. From the people involved at Bletchley Park with the base build and the restoration of this building so that we could put the exhibition into it to bring it back into heritage use, and all the companies that they were involved with. And we haven't even touched on that in this episode. But also Emily, our interpretation lead, who's drawn all these really varied and complex stories together in a way that's really... hopefully enjoyable and easy for visitors to understand. We've also had our visitor research and our evaluation. We've done none of this exhibition without asking visitors and families and people who aren't experts in Bletchley Park what they like to experience and what they're interested in and how they want to find out about these stories. But we've had access consultants involved with this as well. Obviously, our content and research team, as you say, are like the historians, but our curatorial and archive team working on not just on the objects that are on display, but also providing our collections and making them available and scanning them so that all of these lovely replicas and handling objects that we've got are still usable. But we've had our graphic designers, our 3D interpretive designers making the exhibition the thing it is, as you can see. Filmmakers, our sound editors like yourself, and sound designers, lighting designers, our lenders and donors and sponsors, without which a lot of this exhibition isn't possible, advisors, specialists, I mean, our interactive designers, you absolutely loved, our digital interactives, but we've got mechanical interactives here as well. The companies that actually built the exhibition, created the furniture and the showcases and all of that, and then the project management and governance that brings it all together, and more. I mean, it's huge. You're saying dozens and dozens. I'd say, you know, over 100 people involved, hundreds involved in making this happen. And so to have organized all of that to the point that visitors can come in and experience it as part of their visit here to the site, it's just an honor to be part of that huge effort from Bletchley Park and all the organizations it's worked with.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.